Let me pray and we'll get started. Father our God, we always love your word and really relish digging into it, thinking it through. Give us wisdom this morning as we begin to contemplate some of the applications of the large and sweeping passages that we have spent time down in the trenches exegeting, and help us to begin to bring out some of the practical implications and answer some of the questions that these things raise, and give us wisdom. And thank you that you have provided so much for us in terms of understanding these things that, as I say many times, we are standing on the shoulders of giants, and we want to be faithful, but we thank you that you equip us to do these things. In Christ's name we pray, amen. Well, I've mentioned to a few of you before class that we're getting ready to get into a section that's, this is where the rubber meets the road. This is kind of more of the practical type application of things. And I will confess to you that I didn't put together the volume of material that I had hoped to, because I'm trying to make sure I get the pieces in place. One of the things I'm doing, I've studied this for years, as you can tell, and have taught it a number of times, but I've never taught it to the level and depth that I'm teaching it now. You all have given me the opportunity to speak at length on the subject, and so when I have more time to speak, I put more into it and try to dig deeper. And for example, one of the things that we're going to do that I haven't tried to do in the past, because I just haven't had time, that I've told you, is I'm going to try to find some, at least one book I have in mind, maybe there'll be some others, that give a critique of New Covenant theology. And it's not going to be somebody who's just, you know, we could just dismiss sort of out of hand, like, oh my goodness. It's going to be somebody who's theologically taught and who's going to come at us with some challenging arguments. And my intention when we get there, we're not there yet to that part, but my intention when we get there is to recommend you all get the book if you want to. If you don't, I will summarize it sort of chapter by chapter and try to be fair with it. And presumably there will be those in the audience who have read along with me, so they can say, wait a minute, you didn't get that quite right. Or, hey, what about this point? You didn't mention that, and so forth. So there'll be a lot of accountability in that. And I'm going to try during that section to present what's said and then kind of throw it to you all to wrestle with for a while before I weigh in on it. Because I feel like, you know, for me just to come in and say, well, he said this, and this is what's wrong with that. I mean, that's okay, but I think you will be more stretched and challenged if you are able to wrestle with that. So, since I'm planning to do that, I need to equip you well, right? And so that puts a challenge on me. And so I've been trying to think through some of the things that we're grappling with here and think about, okay, let's be a little, sometimes we want to put things in real simple terms, and that's okay. It's kind of like when you first learn math, you know, or you first learn science or something like that, you know, first learn the laws of physics, you know, and then you get into the theory of relativity and find out, well, some of that stuff was a little oversimplified, you know, and you long for the days when it was simple. So theology gets that way sometimes too. So we're gonna start developing some nuances here, and my material today may run a little bit short, but I would rather do that and lay a good foundation. And plus, I think you may have some questions today, so we'll see how that goes. But we'll be on this for a while. So we're going to look at questions raised by New Covenant theology. These are going to be questions that I anticipate are raised. Of course, we give you opportunity to raise them all along, and we'll allow you to do so at the end as well. And in particular today, I'm going to raise this question, and I think it's going to take us at least a couple of weeks to really get our arms around this one. Here's the question. Are the laws and commandments given in the Old Testament binding on New Covenant Christians today? I suspect most of you are sitting there thinking, I know the answer to that. And you're probably right, but let's just take a look. Here's what we've seen so far, and I'm talking about recent weeks where we've laid things out. And I'm going to only summarize those things that pertain to this question. I'm not going to summarize everything. First of all, we've seen that the laws given in the Old Testament were designed to regulate the people of Israel living under the Old Covenant. We covered that all the way back when we started talking about covenants, and I pointed out those that were given to Israel, even the Ten Commandments given to Israel, those the Sabbath is having to do with it's the sign of the Old Covenant, which the Jews were under. I've made a big deal about that. So we've seen that. And we've seen where the writer of Hebrews tells us that the Old Covenant has now been made obsolete. Remember, we spent several weeks developing and working through Hebrews chapter 8, verses 6 through 13. The writer of Hebrews tells us that the Old Covenant has now been made obsolete by a superior new covenant with a new high priest, being Jesus. And remember, I talked about, he deals with some very complex theological arguments that would have been on the mind of Jews, like, hey, wait a minute, wasn't the priest after the order of Levi? And Jesus isn't after the order of Levi. He came from the tribe of Judah. And he said, that's right. Jesus is under a higher priesthood, Melchizedek. And he develops that whole argument. And we didn't go way into that, but we mentioned it. So we have a new covenant that makes the old one obsolete. He quotes Jeremiah 31:31 in that regard. And he talks about Jesus being a new priest and a new priesthood. And a passage we didn't particularly look at, but just it comes earlier in his book, is consequently the writer of Hebrew tells us where there's a change in priesthood, there is necessarily a change in law as well. That's not going to be a surprise to any of us. Honestly, you know, if I really wanted to go full bore, I suppose we'd have to almost cover the whole book of Hebrews. The whole book of Hebrews is like New Covenant theology. It's basically what it is. And I've just tried to summarize and hit some of the high points. But there's that. But more than that, what we have looked at is Paul tells us, for example, and we saw this last week. In fact, the last 3 weeks we've been, you know, really working our way through a very difficult text in Galatians 3. And there we saw Paul tells us that the laws given in the Old Testament were put in place only until Christ, the promised seed of Abraham, came. And then there's an end point there. It stops. The Mosaic law stops. No longer goes on. And we made that real clear. We showed how the Reform thinkers sometimes try to get around that, and we showed what was wrong with that, and we went into all that last week. So, just summarizing. And then several weeks before that, when we were talking about the things about the New Covenant, we pointed out that, furthermore, Paul tells us in the book of Ephesians that the law of Moses served as a barrier between Jews and Gentiles in Old Testament times. You remember that? Because the Jews were set aside as a very peculiar people, and they weren't allowed to associate with the Gentiles. Remember, even Peter in the book of Acts is still functioning under that paradigm when God tells him to first of all, to eat certain kinds of food. He says, oh, I never eat that kind of food. And God says, if I tell you to eat that food, eat it. And then he said, now I want you to go to a Gentile. And so now Peter's been made ready to do something that in the Old Testament could have never happened. There was a division between Jews and Gentiles. And the law put that barrier there on purpose. But now that barrier has been ripped out. It's been removed by Jesus' death on the cross. And that's the middle wall of partition. It's almost a physical structure that existed in the Jewish temple that divided the Jews and Gentiles. It's as though, and it was torn, you remember, when Jesus was crucified on the cross. That's almost a metaphor for what actually happened when Jesus died on the cross. The division between Jews and Gentiles was removed. That was the law. The law did that. Paul said it's been removed. And so Paul can say to the Corinthians, and it's really kind of a side point, which is why we haven't spent a lot of time just sitting in the next meeting. He's really talking about evangelism and so forth, but he just makes a side point, and you can't help but notice it because it's so stark. Paul can say to the Corinthians that he, and by implication us, we, is no longer under the Old Testament Jewish law. Remember that? He said, when I get with the Jews, I can put myself under the Jewish law, and I can do the things the Jews do. I know how to be a good Jew. I grew up a Jew. I know how that works. But I'm not under the law. I'm not bound by those things. I don't consider myself somehow having to keep the law of Moses. I only do it voluntarily when it serves to advance my witness with the Jews. He said, but then he quickly adds, now that doesn't mean I'm without any law at all. I'm not lawless, which is sometimes what New Covenant theology proponents are accused of. You're antinomian. You're lawless. Paul said, no, I'm not lawless. I'm under the law of Christ, not the Mosaic law. So now we no longer look to Moses as our lawgiver, we look to Jesus as our lawgiver. And Paul just rattles that out in two verses in 1 Corinthians. So, based on these passages, it would appear that the answer to the question, are Old Testament laws binding on Christians today, would be a resounding no. They're not binding on Christians today. Right? That's what we've been building up to, and that's why we develop things the way that we have. So, ready to close the book and move on. Well, as the John Wayne character might have said in one of the old John Wayne movies, not so fast there, Pilgrim. Because in one sense, that's true. But there are some other things we need to take into consideration. And this is where it gets a little more complicated. Again, I think we come back to, on a simplistic level, the laws of physics are what we studied in the laws of physics. You're going to measure the speed of a car going down the road and all that. Yeah, that's all fine. Even though the laws of relativity end up giving us a higher law. just watch where this goes. From time to time, we also see Paul and other New Testament writers, not just Paul, citing Old Testament laws in a way that seems as though they're still applicable to New Covenant Christians to whom he's writing. Have you seen passages like that? I know some of you have because you've been thinking, yeah, when's he going to get to those? Well, we're getting there. Okay, wait a minute. So the law, very clearly, from Paul and from the writer of Hebrews and so forth, it ended, we're no longer under, and yet he still cites it in a way that makes it appear as though it's binding in some sense. How does that work? And I'm going to give you some specific examples here in a minute. So that's the question. Why would the New Testament writers cite Old Testament laws in this way if the Old Testament laws have been abolished and we're no longer bound by them? I'll leave a pregnant pause there for you to think about that. Why is that? Why would that happen? Anybody want to guess? Just, you can throw one out there if you want to. Nobody brave this morning. All right. We need to back up. We have to remember that the purpose of laws in any age, under any covenant, is to define what is holy and righteous and good. There's your passage, Tim. Tim came up to me before classes. I know I missed some classes, but have you ever looked at this passage in Romans? Yeah. I think that's, you know, Paul says about the law of Moses in particular that it's holy, righteous, and good. And yeah, you know, there's some places where, like we see in Corinthians, it's talk about, it almost seems like the law is like somehow evil or bad, or, you know, it's the it brings death. It sounds, but then, you know, Paul, anytime he asks himself a question, he says, no, the law's good. You know, serve a purpose. And we've explained all that in each passage we've gone through. But any law, whether the law of Moses or any other law, is to define what is holy and righteous and good for those under that law. That would be true of the law of Moses. That would be true of the law of Christ. That would be true of specific individual commandments. Maybe it's not a law in a sense of a set of books or something, you know, like a specific command given to Adam in the garden or what have you. Ultimately, it is the character of God that defines what is holy and righteous and good. And we, as his image bearers, though we be fallen image bearers, of course, we as his image bearers are then called to be holy as he is holy. Remember that Peter talks about that. Regardless of what covenant we're under. So God is the ultimate definition of what is holy and right and good, right? And as his image bearers, we're to be holy and righteous and good. It says that in Leviticus, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. It says that in the New Covenant. It is written. I mean, he's quoting probably from Leviticus. You shall be holy, for I am holy. Okay. The ultimate duty of all men in all ages is summarized by Jesus when he says, And this is a well-known passage. You all have heard this. Matthew 22. In fact, a couple of the Gospels record this or a similar statement by Jesus. Jesus said to the Pharisee lawyer who asked him a question, "You shall love." He said, "What is the great command? What is the great commandment?" And Jesus said, "You want to know the great commandment? I'll give it to you. There's two of them. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind. That's the first commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets." So there's all kind of stuff in the law, but ultimately, everything in the law points to those two major ideas. That's the sweeping, overarching idea requirement that's being met by what's said in the law. And that's likewise the requirements of all that's given in the new covenant. It's the same thing. That's why Jesus brings it up in response to that question. At times, loving God with all your heart will require a specific person or people to obey a specific command that God has given only to them. So, for example, take some really obvious examples. Adam was told not to eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the garden, right? This is before he fell. Well, if Adam is to love God with all his heart, soul, and mind, he will obey that command, right? Are you careful to obey that command? We don't even know what a tree is, right? I mean, that doesn't apply to us. I suppose if we were in the garden, maybe you could argue it would. But the point is, that's a specific thing for a specific person. Take another one. This is often quoted by people who hate the Bible. The Israelites were told in 1 Samuel to kill every man, woman, and child in the city of Amalek. Remember that? That was a specific command given to a specific people, the Israelites at that time, to do in that specific instance. But that's not something that we obey. Right? It was a holy act because the people of Amalek were unrighteous. God had judged them, and they were carrying out God's judgment in response to their love for God by obeying God. And that's how they do that. That's the highest command. But there are other things that are wrong for all men in all ages because they violate the two great commandments cited by Jesus. For example, murder. Taking the life of an innocent person, that's how we define murder, is wrong for all men in all ages. Why? Well, because it's unloving toward our neighbor. We kill him without cause. And it's unloving toward God, because when we murder, we destroy an image bearer of God. And God makes his point about murder. This is true in all ages, right? Cain was wrong to kill his brother Abel. And God comes and to him in judgment after the murder takes place and condemns what happened. First murder in human history. This is before any laws were given. This is before there were hardly any people around. It's some of the first two children. And then still, prior to the law of Moses, Noah is told that murder is wrong. You know, there's a lot going on with Noah and the ark and the sinfulness of man, all that kind of thing. But one of the things that is recorded for us in the book of Genesis that God makes a big deal about with Noah is that murder is wrong. And in fact, God institutes the idea of what we now refer to as capital punishment on that occasion. This is before the giving of the law. That if someone does murder someone, their life is to be taken. So it's the idea of if you murder, the right and just penalty is that you die yourself. And God has instituted that, and that's the holy and right thing to do. And it's true in all ages. The law of Moses forbids murder. It's in the Ten Commandments. I could quote many citations. I'll just give you one example in each of these. And of course, murder is condemned in the New Covenant all over the place. Again, I just gave one example in Romans 1:29, where it lists a whole bunch of sins, and murder is one of them, but many, many places. So because there are many places where the Old Testament law addresses a moral principle that is still binding on Christians today, the New Testament writers will sometimes cite an Old Testament law when speaking to New Covenant Christians. And I think that's one valid use of Old Testament law. We have to be careful with that, because you have to make sure it's not, you know, there's some categories where, no, that's no longer applicable, you know, things in the law. But there are things in the law that address things that are moral across the ages. That's a very appropriate place to draw from the wisdom given in the law, because the law was given to produce, or to at least define, holiness. And often, in citing the Old Testament law, the New Testament writer will upgrade or even modify the Old Testament law to be more fitting in the New Covenant age. And this is where we're going to take a few weeks, because next week I want to do this. We started to do this a little bit several weeks back. We looked at I alluded to the Sermon on the Mount, and I took that statement where Jesus said, "I've not come to destroy the law, but to fulfill it." Remember that? And I started talking a little bit about the Sermon on the Mount. I'd like to walk us through the Sermon on the Mount, because I think Jesus does this all over the place in the Sermon on the Mount. So I'll leave that example for next week, because I didn't want to try to get into that this week. I want to give some other examples first, and then we'll get to that next time. So let's give several examples where New Testament writers do this. Okay, here's example number one. And by the way, this is an exhaustive list at all. It's just some of the more well-known ones. Ephesians 6, verses 1 through 3. "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, for this is the first commandment with a promise." Okay, so here's Paul writing to the Ephesians in the New Testament to New Covenant believers. In fact, this is the book where he talks about the law was a dividing point between Jew and Gentile, and Jesus removed it. This is in that same letter that he's making his statement. And Paul knows what he's doing, so we have to put these things together. And he says, "Honor your father and mother," which is the first commandment. When was that commandment given? Well, y'all know that. Ten Commandments. Law of Moses. Right there, front and center. You know, the Ten Commandments, I presented them to you as sort of the summary statement of the entire Old Covenant. You can't get any more Old Covenant Mosaic law than that. Right there in the middle. And Paul quotes it. And when he's writing to children, New Covenant children, he says, "Children, you New Covenant children, obey your parents. For this is right." Remember I told you the law defines what is holy and righteous and good. This is right that children obey parents. That's the way I made man. That's the role I put parents in, God says. It's holy for children to do this in any age. In any age. "Honor your father and mother." It's the first commandment with a promise. So he's pointing out that when it was given in the Old Testament, there were several commands given, and this one has a promise with it, sort of giving it a special place. He said this command had a special place in the law, and it should have a special place for you. And Paul's going to make a promise to them that it may go well with you and that you may enjoy long life on the earth. Is that what it says in the Old Testament? Close. Exodus 20, this is the Ten Commandments. "Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land the Lord your God is giving you." Okay, it's a little bit of a twist, because the original commandment was given in a context where they were about to go into a land. God wanted them to live holy lives in that land. And so he said, your days will be long there. Well, the Ephesians weren't given a land that they're about to go into, so Paul has to kind of upgrade for obvious reasons. Interestingly enough, the word for land and the word for eretz, the word for earth in Hebrew is eretz, which is the same Hebrew word. So it's not a big stretch to do that. But he upgrades it. But the basic idea of children honoring their parents is the same. And it's good for kids to do that. Not only is it right, he says, but children will benefit from obeying their parents. Because we had a whole class in here on child training, right? And we emphasized the importance of that. The importance of it's loving for you to make your kids obedient children, to enforce the discipline necessary and to train them and all that sort of thing. it's not only good for you as parents, that's your role, it's what you're commanded to do, but it's good for your kids. You love your kids if you teach them to be obedient so they may live long on the earth, generally speaking. So I just point out in a bullet point what I just told you. He upgrades the language. Doesn't always do that, but in this case he did. Jesus does it quite a bit in the Sermon on the Mount. We're going to see that again when we get to that next week. But let's just get a couple more examples. Like I said, we don't have a tremendous amount this morning. I want to give you all a chance to process this, and I hope there'll be some discussion, because we're kind of giving some new ideas here. Some of you have probably been wondering about some of this, and so hopefully this is going to start to address some questions you've had in your mind. So here's example number two. It's Romans 13, and Paul says, "For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet." Okay, commandments. Where do we find those commandments? Ten commandments, right? And any other commandments, just kind of throws it out there as a general statement, are summed up in this word: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Remember what I said a minute ago, that I believe that's one of the overarching principles that sums up right behavior in any age. And he goes on and says, love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is fulfilling the law. Again, just like Jesus said, I have come not to destroy the law, but to fulfill it. We fulfill the law under the new covenant by doing what is right by the power of the Spirit and by God's grace. And so we're fulfilling the law in that sense. And so he quotes from the law here. And Paul, again, is not saying here that we're under the law of Moses per se. Otherwise, he'd be contradicting what he said even in the same letter. He says it in Romans 2. You know, there are scholars who said, you know, Paul seems to have a love-hate thing with the law. And it takes some hard thinking to sort it out. Because you can either say Paul's a madman and contradicts himself left and right. Well, obviously, none of us believe that. It's the Word of God. So we've got to figure out, how do these two things fit together? And that's what I'm trying to do for you. I'm trying to fit these things together so that we can understand them and not miss either idea. Paul's merely pointing out that when we obey Christ's command to love our neighbor, we do no wrong to our neighbor and thereby fulfill the righteousness demanded by the law. Okay, one more example, just a quick one. Now, 1 Corinthians 14. As in all the churches of the saints, the women should keep silent in the churches, for they're not permitted to speak, but should be in submission, as the law also says. I know some of you are probably thinking, hey, let's go into that passage. What's that talking about? That's not our purpose today. That's a passage that would take a while to develop. I just want you to get the idea here. Paul is giving an instruction to the church at Corinth. And he's talking about what should take place in the church assembly. Remember, a church is, even though today we talk about the church, we're talking about the building. In the New Testament, the church is never the building. The church is the gathered people, the assembly, the called out ones. And he's saying in the called out assembly that men were to be teaching and leading. And there was even, I believe, interaction that took place in that setting. I know it's a little different than we do it today sometimes. We do it that way in Sunday school class, but... anyways, he is instructing that the women would not participate in that. Think what you will about that. That's not our point. Point is, they're to do this for, he gives the reason, they're not permitted to speak, but be in submission, as the law also says. So he says, you know, I'm telling you this because it's right for women to be in submission, and in this case, submission shows itself by them allowing the men to lead and to carry on a discussion. And he says the law says the same thing about women. Now, you know, lots of ink spilled on exactly where the law is, because the law doesn't put it in those exact words, but the law does teach the idea of submission of women in many places. And, you know, Paul makes that point in a number of places in the New Testament. Again, that's another whole wide subject. But the thing I'm trying to point out here is he's using the law for reinforcement. And, you know, you might be tempted to go, well, why we need the law to say something? I mean, if you said it, it's good enough. Well, it is good enough that Paul said it. But he's pointing out the fact this is something that's right. And this is something that is true for all ages. So the law also says it. And again, principle of women submitting is a timeless principle established by God when he created the first man and woman. We see that spelled out for us in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 8 through 9. And therefore is a requirement in the law of Moses as well as the law of Christ. So it's a timeless principle. All right. That's as far as we're going to go this morning. And I want to give you all some time to ask questions. Hopefully you have some. Give you some time to chew on. Next week we're going to kind of review some of this stuff briefly, and we're going to advance further. I'm going to give you some examples from Christ's teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, and show you how Christ quotes from the Old Testament and how he upgrades the law in many ways. We're going to show you that. And we're going to also talk a little bit more about this idea of that which is right. And because this is something that theologians talk about. You'll hear theologians use the term the moral law. Those of you who study theology, have you heard that term, the moral law? Well, what is that? Because the Bible doesn't use that term particularly. So but that doesn't mean it's necessarily wrong to use a term, because a term may describe something that the Bible teaches, and if it does, then it's fine. You have to come up with a term for it. So we're going to look at that idea. You sometimes hear in philosophical circles, and even we hear it being discussed, like as judges are now being reviewed by the Senate and whatnot, natural law. Have you heard of that? And so we're going to show how this ties into that. I hope to cover that next week. So we got some really good stuff on tap next week. But at this point, I want to just kind of open it up for questions while we have a little bit of time. Plenty of time to ask questions, so fire away. Or if you want to make a comment. Yes?
This is a very broad question. But growing up, I was kind of taught that if you took everything out of the Old Testament, there wasn't contradicted in the New Testament. So you would follow the Ten Commandments except for the Sabbath, because Jesus talked on that. could we just take it as we follow everything out of the Old Testament as long as it wasn't addressed in the New Testament? Or?
That's a very good question. There are two approaches taken to this, and I think they're both a little bit oversimplified, and I think one comes closer to the truth than the other. So, okay, that's one. And there's a similar set of questions raised about how we do things in the church service, but I'll get to that in a minute. Okay, so one view is that if it's in the Old Testament law, unless the New Testament rescinds it or takes it back or says it's null and void, then it's still binding. Okay? The other view is the only thing we're under is you take everything that's in the New Testament, and the only time you obey things that are in the Old Testament is if it's reinforced in the New Testament. Otherwise, the Old Testament doesn't apply to us at all. So if somebody comes up with something and says, you shall not wear, in the Old Testament says, you shall not wear mixed fabrics in your clothing. Okay. The New Testament doesn't come back and say, no, that's okay to wear polyester or whatever, you know. It doesn't say that. So under one school of thought, I presume you would have to say, well, then we can't, that's still binding on us. But the other school of thought would say, no, I mean, that was an old covenant thing. It was part of the peculiarity of the Jews and all the crazy things that you know, they had to do, if you want to think of it that way. And that's not right. That's not a New Testament principle. We're under the New Testament. Those are the two things that are out there. And I think they're both oversimplified, although I think the second one's closer to the truth. It's the position I would take. It doesn't make it right. I'm just telling you where I'm coming from. You'll have to sort through that yourself, and that's part of what we're doing in this section, is just kind of grapple through that. What I want to say, to try to be more accurate, is that the whole Old Testament law, because it's fulfilled in Christ, the whole Old Testament law is binding on us, but only as we view it through our Christ glasses. In other words, as it's been, Christ has taken the law, and the way he's fulfilled it and modified it, it now binds on us in a modified way. So, for example, let's take a real obvious one. Animal sacrifices. Anytime you commit a sin, a sacrifice has to be offered for that sin, right? So, well, you say, well, the New Testament says we don't have to do that. In fact, it's wrong for you to do that now. The book of Hebrews talks about that. But in a sense, we do that. But we do it differently. How do we do it? When we commit a sin, there does have to be a sacrifice. Jesus. So we keep that law. We keep the requirement that a sacrifice be offered for sin with the reality instead of the prefiguring picture, the sacrifice. So we're, in a sense, keeping that law. Does that make sense? So, and you can do that with any of the laws. I think we'll do that when we get to the Sabbath, I think. And that's another whole set. We'll have a whole class on that, so we don't have to get into that now. But all those Old Testament laws, in a sense, pointed to something and can be brought about in fulfillment. Now, easier said than done in some cases, because there are some laws that are just really interesting. How do you keep that, you know? But I think you just have to try to look at the New and Old Testament and put the two together. I think by and large, at a practical level, unless it's in the New Testament, it's probably not binding. But here's the thing. Okay, here's where we get in trouble on the other side of it. So I showed one way you get in trouble. Nowhere in the New Testament does it say that bestiality is wrong. Nowhere. So is bestiality okay? New Testament doesn't say it's wrong. Ah, but it does. Okay? It says porneia is wrong. Sexual immorality is wrong. And that's a form of sexual immorality. Okay, but how would you know that? Well, if you say, well, I don't think that's sexually immoral. You know, I mean, nowadays you can almost believe somebody would say something goofy like that. They say goofy things today, right? So how do you... So the law then becomes a way to sort of inform us on what some of these things really mean. What is porneia, really? And the law spells it out in great detail. Of course, the New Testament does, too, to some degree. It spells out, certainly homosexuality is spelled out in Romans real clearly. Fortunately for us in today's age, right, because they're trying to say, oh, no, the Bible doesn't really teach against that. Some of these churches are saying that, liberal churches. So, but the Old Testament can inform us. Or another example, the New Testament teaches that capital punishment is good. Romans 13, right? The rulers that God has put in place as governing authorities were not given the sword. That's the ability to kill. They were not given that power in vain. It's so that they can punish evildoers. They're serving God when they do that, when they institute capital punishment. But it doesn't tell us what is a valid thing to have capital punishment for or not. Right? So you need the Old Testament to inform you maybe on that. But again, you got to be careful, because there were things in the Old Testament, like the Sabbath keeping was a death penalty thing. I'm not expecting our government to put people to death for not keeping the Sabbath, because we, you know, you see what I'm saying? This is, I'm not trying to get you confused. I'm just trying to show you it's a lot more complicated than we want to make it right away. And I love things to be simple, especially as a teacher. You're always trying to make things simple for your class to follow. And when you first start teaching something, when you're teaching a younger class or a newer group, you know, you start out with, you just oversimplify just so they can get it. You know, otherwise, if you start giving everybody all the nuances on the first day of class, it's like, oh, I'll never get this, you know. But I'm just trying to show you we need to be a little more nuanced, especially if we're going to deal with a book like the one we may go through. You're going to be throwing some tough questions. And I've been throwing some tough, we're all throwing tough questions. And we should be throwing tough questions. We need to think through. So, does that make sense? That's a great question. That's right at the heart of what we're talking about. Other thoughts or questions? Tim, come back here where I can pick you up on the mic.
Reading through Acts this week, and when I got to the Jerusalem Council, Acts 15, and I see that the Jews and Gentiles are struggling about circumcision, whether or not to require that, or as you said, the word you use, binding.
Yeah.
Just binding on the Greeks, the Gentiles. I thought it was interesting that as they got to their conclusion, there's obviously a struggle with the early church trying to figure out the answer to this. And James concludes that, no, we don't need to do this. But for some simple requirements, they need to abstain from food sacrificed to idols.
Food sacrificed to idols and blood.
Yeah, strangling blood and sexual immorality.
Yeah.
And I ran into a perspective on that being that that was a kind of, with the exception of sexual immorality, that the other two were kind of a compromise.
Yeah.
In the same way that Paul had Timothy circumcised.
Yes.
So that, you know, we're given some give and take here with these Jewish believers. And so we're going to require some things, though in no way does this affect their justification.
No.
But we're going to go through some of the motions because it's giving us an audience with the Jews.
Yep.
And so I'm wondering, you talk about nuances.
Yeah.
I mean, there are lots of
that's a good example
in what portions of the Old Testament we keep for the simple fact that this helps us be a better contributor to society or helps us in our evangelism efforts and things like that.
Yeah. That's a great example because that's one of, you know, and I think the conclusion that you voiced there is where I would tend to go with it personally, but it does take some wrestling. You know, it fills in sexual morality with, you know, food sacrifice to idols, which, you know, Paul has a whole discussion about nothing wrong with food sacrifice to idols. He clearly makes that known to us in when he writes later to the, was it the Romans or the Corinthians or both? But so, yeah, we got to, you know, that's where sometimes you get down into the weeds. And I don't know that you can always, I mean, we're always learning, and I'd like to tell you we can always come right down to a black and white answer in every case. I love black and white. I love to get there. And I try to get there. I think we should try to get there. But I will be honest with you, there are times in my study of the Scriptures where I'm always growing and learning, and there are times I wrestle with a text and I'm not quite sure which way to go. I think I lean this way, but it may be that way, you know.
The person I was reading that was trying to interpret that decision in Acts 15 is they conveyed their assumption that Paul was not happy with James's compromise of, hey, I thought we said we're not requiring the Gentiles, and yet you come back and you've come up with these three rules to keep.
Yeah, I can see why somebody might say that. Personally, there are a lot of assumptions made about Paul and James. You know, justification is another big one. Romans 4 versus James.
Yeah.
You know, we are justified by works. We're not justified by works. You know, which one is it? You know, but I think if you take each of them in their right context, I don't believe there is that contradiction. Before I would believe that the two of them, apostles, both in good standing, were wrong, I would want to see a dispute take place where that was made clear. For example, Paul does confront Peter.
Right.
And in that case, he calls him out, and I believe rightfully so. So, yeah, that gets into some other areas as well.
Well, all to say the nuances you're talking about, these letters are being written in real time with the struggles that the church is going through, the Jews and the Gentiles. Law or no law?
Yeah.
Requirement or no? And he's got, you know, at risk of saying, putting his foot down and completely alienating one audience. He's like, hey, listen to me here. Let's work through this.
Yeah.
And I know you're not totally where I am in this complete justification by faith alone.
Yeah.
Understanding. So he's almost having to come to the Jews to take their hand and bring them to where he's coming from.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of, my preparation for this class was to, and sometimes you have to do this as a teacher, you can't just like study for the specific thing you're going to say, you have to read broadly. And my wife would say, I've been just like all week, I've been just kind of like reading and reading and reading and absorbing and absorbing and absorbing. In fact, even on my vacation last week, I took a book with me to read. because it's good to steep your mind in a lot of things so that you get a broader perspective. Then you have to sit down and start figure out what you want to type up and say, you know, based on that broad information. One of the things I remember coming across was that one writer commented that if it hadn't been for the Gentiles and Paul bringing the Gentiles into the church, God really bringing the Gentiles into the church through Paul's ministry, the early Jews would have been happy to just keep on keeping the law and everything would have just gone along hunky-dory. There was no problem there. But, and it created a crisis of sorts because now you've got Gentiles coming in and Paul's saying, we're not under the law. You can be under it if you want to, but you cannot impose the law on others. And that's the difference. That's a major distinction, I think. Other thoughts? These are all good thoughts that we're having. Let's see how we're looking at time. We're almost out of time, but if somebody had a quick question, we could get it in. Yeah?
When we're finished with that, I want to talk about favorites tonight.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to save a minute or two for that.
Okay. All right. Anybody else? Quick on that. Let me close this in prayer. So, and then if y'all just hang for a second and let Andre talk about care groups tonight. Father, thank you for some of these ideas that we're now wrestling with. Give us wisdom. This requires wisdom. And the last thing we want to do is oversimplify your word, but at the same time, we don't want to miss anything that's said. And we know that you give wisdom to those who seek it, and we approach you in faith with that idea, and are thankful for the opportunity we have in this class to work through some of these things in your scriptures. In Christ's name we pray, amen. Okay, y'all, go ahead, Andre.
The Schneiders are out.